Good morning and welcome to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg and I'll be your host for this morning's show. Today, the moles take up some pretty big issues like love, death, loss, freedom, struggle, democracy, and of course, the weather, because who is not talking about the weather right now? I do hope all of you out there in KBOO land are managing to stay safe and cool during this absolutely unprecedented heat wave. Today, to talk about the weather, we have the Mole's in-house climate investigator, Bill Resnick, in the second of his two-part interview with climate expert Richard A. Smith. For the rest of the show, we have two reviews. Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Joe Clement review the animated film Coco, and Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews the novel Of Women and Salt. To close out the hour, Tom Becker, our well-read Red, will share a recently published piece about overcoming our own anti-democratic history by abolishing the U.S. Senate. By the way, you won't hear this kind of programming on corporate radio. If you enjoy listening to the Old Mole and the many other public affairs programs that air on KBOO, please consider supporting the station. KBOO depends on listeners like you to stay on the air. To make a contribution, you can go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner, or you can send a check to 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, 97214. And thanks to all of you out there who have already generously given to keep community radio alive. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and his guest, Richard A. Smith.
Hi, Richard Smith. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Happy to be here again.
Richard Smith is a historian of modern China, also an environmental activist. He co-founded the organization System Change, Not Climate Change. His books and writing include China's Engine of Environmental Collapse, just out this year. Previously, he wrote Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And he's written many important articles, all quite accessible on the net. In part one last week of this two-part interview, we discussed whether human society can survive climate change. We concluded that exponential growth is just not possible on a finite planet, and that we must replace capitalism with a production system that's democratic and sustainable. In part two today, we'll first discuss the human future as the people here and around the planet, as they wake up to the reality of climate change. In a period maybe 5 or 10 or even 20 years from now, in the period of multiple and frightening climate disasters and looming disasters, people wake up to demand action. Second today, Richard and I will discuss how we here in this country can build the movements that can overcome elite and capitalist resistance to our plan so that we gain power and authority to direct the mobilization of people and economies across the planet that will be necessary to stop climate warming. Richard Smith, the distinguished eco-socialist Michael Lowy, conducted in thesis one of his monthly review essay, 13 Theses on the Imminent Ecological Catastrophe and the Revolutionary Means of Averting It. He contended that the ecological crisis is already the most important social and political question of the 21st century, and will become even more so in the coming months and years. In the last paragraph of your essay, An Eco-Socialist Path to Limiting Temperature Rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, that was in the Real World Economic Review, you offer your sense of the immediate future, that there will be intensifying climate disasters. And then, I quote, people everywhere will look for government to do what the science demands before it's too late. So, Richard, give us more detail, your sense about the changing climate and how the people will react.
Well, thanks, Bill, for the introduction. Of course, the most difficult thing we face is that we're organizing, fighting a struggle here for not just for a class, but for the whole of humanity. And the problem is, of course, the changes that we need to make are wrenching changes that are going to affect every single person. You know, we're going to have to sacrifice a lot of industries. We're going to cut back on production of all kinds of things. We're going to have to ration airplane flights. We're going to have to abolish the annual new car automobile charade. We're going to have to abolish iPhones 12, 13, 14. Now, you can't have phones, but you can have phones that can last for decades and not be tossed out and replaced every 2-3 years. So it's going to be huge changes in jobs and kinds of consumption and so forth, which have the opportunity for us to create a better world for us and our children in the future. But in the meantime, it's very, very difficult to organize people for that, because the intuitive understanding of people is that what we need to do to suppress fossil fuel emissions impacts jobs and levels of consumption. And they're right about that. It does. That's the problem. So the only way, as I tried to argue in my Eco-Socialist Path article, we need to close down industries like the coal industry, the oil industry, much of the auto industry, suppress many kinds of production of chemicals and plastics and just all kinds of things, synthetic fabrics, you name it. We just cannot build an eco-socialist economy with an economy built on perpetual expansion, a perpetual consumption of and perpetual invention of new needs we don't really need, and perpetual consumption of resources to make those. So if we're going to cut back on these things and reorganize our economy, we have to give new jobs. We have to guarantee new jobs to every single person that's affected across the entire industrial economy. And pitches have been made in that direction. Bernie Sanders did say that in the small print in his program. He didn't emphasize it enough in talking to people. He talked about the need to suppress fossil fuel emissions, but he didn't say, I want to guarantee every single person a new job. And that's not quite the same thing as saying new solar panel and wind turbine industries will create new jobs. People need guarantees of jobs. They can't just depend on pie in the sky, oh, hopefully we'll get a new job down there someday, because in the meantime, they're going to try to hold on to what they have, which are fossil fuel-based jobs, and that's a rational thing for them to do for themselves and their families, but it's a suicidal thing to do in the collective.
Right. It seems to me that 5 years from now, 20 years from now, it's not at all clear, but the scientists are clear. We are moving into a period of immense climate disasters. And as you pointed out, the people are going to then begin understanding. Let me quote you here. The people everywhere will look for government to do what the science demands before it's too late. Now, my sense is that we aren't going to be the only one. At that point, when the demands are desperate and loud and majoritarian, to say the least, at that point, the people who run industry, our national elites, the elites of the world, are also going to wake up, and their propagandists and their pundits and their bought intellectuals and their advertising firms and public relations firms, they're going to be way ahead of it. And they're going to tell capital, and capital is going to know it themselves, that they have to stop the left. They cannot allow the left to be the only people with a program. When the people demand change, they're going to have to offer something. What do you see? You've written on it. Tell us about the corporate program now, greenwashing, you know, their geoengineering, carbon sequestration. Tell us what they're doing, Richard. And then we can start talking in more detail about what we can do now. But first, tell us what the corporate capital and their many, many arms are going to start offering.
Well, it goes without saying that capitalist industrialists are not inclined to want to cut back on production or let alone close industries. But this is imperative, and there is no way around this. But what I proposed in my Eco-Socialist Path article is that, quite amazingly, society could buy them out. You know, we don't really have decades to wage a class struggle to overthrow the capitalists and nationalize their industries by force. It makes so much more sense to simply buy them out, and we could do that. The entire fossil fuel industrial structure in the U.S., the oil companies, the coal companies, the distribution network, the auto industry, the aviation industry, which is Boeing, basically, and the plastics industries, the major chemical companies, the overwhelming majority of downstream fossil fuel consuming industries, that is the chemical industries, the plastics, the pesticides, and so forth that consume fossil fuels, in addition to the fossil fuel producers, the oil companies and so forth. All of this could be bought. This was before COVID. I wrote this in 2019. This is before COVID for about a little less than $3 trillion. In other words, just a little less, actually, than 2.7, which was what Donald Trump had given away as a tax break to the wealthy. So, in other words, one could simply rescind that tax break and pay for a buyout of the entire industrial structure. Quite amazingly cheap. And I ran this by an economist friend of mine to see if he thought the numbers are right. And he said, yeah, the numbers are right. It's really quite an amazing thing here that it's not so expensive as you might think. Nonetheless, we need an across-the-board approach to find ways to phase out, rapidly phase out, close down and phase out the major fossil fuel industrial producers and downstream consumers. There's just no way around that. Everybody wants to talk about transitioning to solar power and wind, and that's fine, but that's only one aspect of that's only part of emissions. The largest share of emissions are produced by transportation, by autos and trucks and airplanes and trains. And those need to be cut back. They need to be fewer cars. We need to ration airplane flights and so forth. But companies can't stay in business like that. So we need to nationalize them, basically take them into public hands, not completely shut them down, but ration flights and suppress the whole industrial new car business and make cars to be rebuildable forever, you know, like Volkswagen Beetles or something like that, electric. And do this in a way that keeps those industries on a reduced scale, but still alive, but producing for reasonably sustainable products. This can be done through nationalizing them, through buyouts and so forth like that. So the capitalists will resist, but they can see the writing on the wall too. So you see right today, you see like Shell Oil and other companies are investing in, you know, they're trying to do what Lord John Brown did back in the 90s with BP. They're trying to turn these companies into energy companies instead of just oil companies. They're investing in solar power and wind power and so on and so forth. And that's fine. That's good. And so some companies will be able to make that transition. Others will not. And they'll collapse or be bought out by society and so forth. So we have to do what we can to make the transition as easy as possible. Of course, it's going to be wrenching and massively difficult, but we have to find a way forward for those companies, because don't forget that the companies are not just evil capitalists at the top. There are plenty of those guys. But don't forget that the major part of the stock of those companies are owned by pension plans and so on and so forth by lots of workers. I mean, about 25% of oil stocks are owned by workers' pension plans. So we don't want to expropriate the workers. We want to buy them out. We don't want to bankrupt the workers here to close down the fossil fuel companies that need to be closed to save the workers. So we need to have a way to do this. And there are ways to do this by taxing and buying them out and various other schemes, you know, monetary extension, so forth. So this can be done. So the capitalists will want to keep things going as much as they can, naturally, logically, for their shareholders, for their employees, too, and for the governments, the states, and so forth, and cities that depend on those industries. They will want to keep them going. But we're going to get to the point that we can't keep going on the way we are. Just look at Florida, that building that collapsed a couple of days ago. It did so most probably because of subsistence and dissolving of the cement by seawater infiltration. The whole of Florida is just completely, you know, it's a sponge. It's a limestone sponge. They built entire cities on this. It's going to be buildings collapsing left and right. And also, the Florida Keys are going underwater now. And they're talking about, oh, well, can we elevate the highways? We can elevate the highways, elevate the houses. No, those highways, those houses are going to go. Those islands are going to go. And most of the coast of Miami is going to go. So when this happens, people are going to say, well, maybe we need to do something about this. Now, it could go in a bad direction. It could go towards some kind of eco-fascism. Who knows? You know, I don't know. I mean, all we can do is try to propagandize as much as we can for the most democratic possible solutions we can. Popular control, popular power, and system-wide democratization. That's our best hope, I think.
This is Bill Resnick on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Richard Smith, an eco-socialist activist and writer who's written Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. He co-founded the organization System Change, Not Climate Change. We've been discussing that climate change is not going to stop. It's continuing. It's going to get worse. There's going to be a point when the people awake, capitalism will have its program ready. We can have our program ready. Richard Smith discussed a number of points in the program, including nationalization of most of the productive structure of the U.S., although saving some of the plants and some of the factories. And, of course, they have to be converted to other forms of producing sustainably. Richard, the question, though, becomes how do we get there to the point when people decide maybe not to nationalize the companies, but what if they decide we need to have an economy like the Roosevelt administration proposed during the Great Depression and then, in fact, imposed as the people were demanding, imposed during World War II, an economy where, in fact, the national federal government was telling the capitalist firms, build airplanes, build tanks, build ports, build weaponry of many kinds, employ women, pay decent wages, although there's nothing to spend money on, and there were a few unfortunate things that Roosevelt demanded of unions. In any event, Pearl Harbor was a massive wake-up call in the same way that Florida going underwater, and not just that, New Orleans as well, the Gulf and most of China, which is only a few feet above sea level, that is certainly the manufacturing areas that you described in your book, and vast droughts, prices spiking. People are going to wake up and demand a command economy. I think it won't be called nationalized. It will be called our survival emergency economy to keep people on Earth alive, especially us. But in fact, it will be a nationalization. There's going to be various committees and agencies and instrumentalities will be set up for planning and for planning that command economy. It seems to me, Richard, that's how it's going to happen. But it's not going to happen unless we operate in the next couple of years before the climate disasters become so frequent that the people become alarmed, so that they're able to imagine our program and imagine that the left is, in fact, correct in what it wants to do versus the corporations who will just call for more research and carbon sequestration and the rest and geoengineering and pouring stuff into the ocean to try and reduce carbon dioxide. Their quack proposals may go down heavily, but we have to show that we can do it. Right now, one of the most important things we can do is show models of how effective it is in an economy, fund model cities, show people that, in fact, renewable energy can work, that electrified transit can work, that with energy conservation and use reduction, that can make it more feasible to build out enough energy supplies. My sense is that in the near future, we have to build out the models. We still have to do blockadia and boycott, divest sanctions of various groups. We certainly have to degrow, as you pointed out, but I'm not sure we have to tell people we have to degrow. In World War II, there was a tremendous degrowth in some ways of consumer goods and conservation of tin and metals, and people accepted degrowth even though we didn't say, sorry, folks, you can't buy a car for the next 3 years, which is, in fact, what happened because there were none available or only a few. But they were able to accept those sacrifices or the common good.
Yeah, no, you're right. The war emergency was quite different than the emergency we face now. For one thing, it was a short duration, a matter of 3 or 4 years, 5 years at the most. Also, it was built on expansion, on tremendous industrial expansion and new industries and so forth. So it led to rapid increase in employment and so forth. Our emergency is kind of the opposite. It's a much bigger emergency in scale, of course. You know, the fate of the human race, humanity, is in the answer to this problem. But it's a different kind of emergency. It asks us to not grow industries so much as reduce industries and suppress many industries and so forth. This is a harder sell for sure. But it does mean, and it does require us to have a common sacrifice. But, you know, there's nobody agitating for this. Nobody's doing this. You know, I mean, Joe Biden is a pale image of FDR and during World War II, you know. But that's what we do need to do. We do need to restructure industries to produce things we need, like solar panels and windmills instead of automobiles and airplanes and condominiums and so forth, you know, for the ruling class. We need to dramatically restructure the whole industrial structure. But in the end, we have to face up to the fact we have to produce a lot less stuff, less services, less electricity, consume less. But in the process, we can have a shorter working day. We can have a fuller life. We can have all we need and plenty without all the surplus stuff and gadgets and junk that we don't need, that we're sold constantly, told we need, you know, everything from Alexa to self-driving cars and space tourism and just, you know, Bitcoin, just on and on and on. The endless creation of nonsense we don't need. This has to be completely overthrown and create a society that produces what we do need, which is the basic necessities for every single person to have a good housing, a good job, good schooling, good health care, and so on and so forth. So it requires a completely different approach to the economy than capitalism. But it will require us to sacrifice in common to produce this better world. And I think people will be happy to do that when they're motivated to do so, when they see a way forward for them to benefit from that. I'm not calling for austerity here. Though we do have to recognize that we do have to do away with some consumer conveniences, like, you know, you could say single wrap plastics and some plastic bags and plastic this and stuff. We just have to do away with those things and we'll manage, you know. Our parents in the 1950s and 40s and 50s didn't have any of this plastic stuff and they weren't living in caves. They were doing very well, thank you very much. And so we can do so again at a much better level. We don't need to have all this disposable junk that's trashing up the oceans and destroying the planet. We need to be pushing on all fronts, creating models, as you say, examples. Those are hugely important, of what can be done in cities, what can be done in industries, and so on and so forth. But it's, of course, difficult when we don't have the reins of power in government and we don't have people in control of industries that are interested in that, but we have to do what we can.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue this dialogue, I hope, in the future. This sort of the command economy, I think that's going to be necessary. People will, in fact, find, as you pointed out, our parents live really, really well with much less junk and smaller houses, but happier ones for sure. I think, and from my point of view, once we start on that path, as the left, in fact, directs the mobilization, people will not want to go back to huge houses to heat for no good reason, and all of the rest of the absurd huge cars to drive around for no reason at all. In fact, that world is already being rejected by the children, the teens and older of America. So, Richard, we'll have to continue. Before we end, though, tell people where they can find your books and writing.
Okay, well, the first place to look is the System Change website, systemchange.climatechange.org. It has a number of my articles and so forth on there. My book, Green Capitalism, the God That Failed, came out in 2016. You can find that on the web and Amazon or wherever, something besides Amazon, hopefully. My book, China's Engine of Environmental Collapse, was published by Pluto last July. Then I have a lot of articles on the web at various journals and so forth. I would mention my article 6 thesis on saving the planet at the Next System Project. The Next System Project is very interesting. It has lots of great contributions. Mine is one of very many really excellent contributions there. So that's a good source to look. And a review of Real World Economics Review. That's a journal I published a lot of articles in. And also in Common Dreams and Truth Out and so forth. Just Google my name and it'll come up. There's also my website, richardanthonysmith.org. I need to add recent publications, but it's got a lot of my old stuff.
Richard Anthony Smith, thanks for talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Woke up this morning with the sun and
That was a song by Heart Attack Alley entitled Two Hot Blues, which I suspect all of us are suffering at the moment. And now I'd like to turn to a review of a just-published debut novel entitled Of Women and Salt by Gabriela Garcia. I'll be reading, as usual, for Bookmole, Larry Bolden, who writes that Gabriel Garcia's 2021 novel is really a collection of interconnected stories spanning several generations of women. They are stories of captivity and the desire for flight and freedom, stories of women and storytellers, of women and salt. The first story is about women cigar rollers in pre-Castro Cuba. Quote, "The air thickened. Maria Isabel had by then breathed so much tobacco dust, she developed regular nosebleeds. But the foreman didn't permit workers to open the window slats more than a sliver. Sunlight would dry the cigars. So she hid her cough. She was the only woman in the workshop. She didn't want to appear weak." End quote. A quick overview. Carmen came from Cuba to the U.S. and has always felt displaced. Her daughter, Jeanette, is addicted to drugs and is determined to find out more about family history, and thus goes from Miami to Cuba to learn more from her grandmother than her very reticent mother will tell her. Carmen has taken in the daughter of a neighbor who has been detained by ICE. In Cuba, the stories of the three women unravel in snippets via the women who write down their histories. Once in Cuba, now under Castro, Jeanette begins to hear or read the stories. Quote, "Study has become a habit among them. Today, they leave behind the cockfight in order to read a newspaper or book. Now they scorn the bullring. Today, it is the theater, the library, and the centers of good association where they are seen in constant attendance." End quote. While the author is quite willing to expose the difficulties of the poor in Castro's Cuba and the racism that is denied and claimed to be only an American problem, she makes it clear that most are much better off than before when American corporations took from Cuba its wealth of natural goods and gave back little. The grandmother in Cuba has seen the brutal treatment of those who shout for change. She sees the coming revolution that is born of blood and poverty. Married to a disenchanted intellectual who joins the struggle, she is denied access to the group of agitators once he knows she is pregnant. Quote, "She placed one hand on her belly and felt the something in her move and stretch as if seeking its freedom, felt as if the whole world were her womb. She wanted to write her own words. She wanted to write her life into existence and endure. Perhaps a piece of her knew death crouched close." End quote. While much of the book is concerned with the political struggles that led to the overthrow of corrupt American-controlled dictators and then the new set of problems under Castro, the author is also swept away by the incredible natural beauty of Cuba. In a chapter titled An Encyclopedia of Birds, the birds become a metaphor for captivity and the struggle for flight and freedom. Quote, "The burrowing parrot, also known as the Patagonian conure, also as the burrowing parakeet, is the only bird species with eyelashes. This is a little-known fact. Another little-known fact is that burrowing parrots, while often purchased as pets, become exasperated if caged too long. Burrowing parrots need interaction. They need color. If you separate two burrowing parrots, in short order the one left behind will die. She will die of loneliness. Birds fly, even if it kills them." End quote. The author speaks as well of the baby jails, where the children of deportees are kept, and of the children's crayon drawings of birds. There is no sun in the drawings. Quote, I don't know what you remember, but they didn't tell us where they were taking us. I thought we were going before a judge, finally. I thought I could argue my case, my credible fear. I had practiced. Instead, they boarded us onto a bus with bars on the windows and dropped us off in Mexico. We were Salvadoran by nationality, but Mexico was just a few hours away, and that's where we'd come from. So there they left us, said, find your way home. We were supposed to be turned over to Mexican immigration officials, but I guess they didn't show up, or they thought we were Mexican. End quote. Story after story about women and children. Quote, Jeanette had added her own words, we are more than we think we are. End quote. I will leave you with the last words of the book, which sum up the author's view quite well. Quote, and though Anna had no idea why Jeanette had written those words, she chose to believe the sentence, the scribble, was a cry across time. Women? Certain women? We are more than we think we are. There was always more. She had no idea what else life would ask of her, force out of her, but right then there was cake and candles and this, a gift. She thought that she too might give away the book someday, though she had no idea to whom. Someone who reminded her of herself, maybe. Someone drawn to stories. End quote. Garcia is a wonderful storyteller, and she understands the power of stories. I have been talking about Gabriela Garcia's novel of Women and Salt. This is Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry Bolden and the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was a song by the famed Cuban band, the Buena Vista Social Club, entitled Amor de Loca Juventud, or The Crazy Love of Youth. Before that, we heard Larry Bolden's review of the novel of Women and Salt. Like the novel, the animated film Coco takes up issues of intergenerational trauma, remembering, and reconciliation. This review by Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Joe Clement originally aired on The Old Mole in 2018 when the movie was first released. Coco is a visually rich tribute to Mexican culture, as well as a children's story that explores a range of themes, including family, traditions, music, growing up, and love and death. In this piece from our archives, we include introductory comments by veteran Old Mole, tech wizard, and resident philosopher Clayton Morgridge, who died in January of 2020. With his introduction, we are reminded of our dear departed comrade and how his spirit continues to guide us. Clayton is lovingly remembered at KBOO as a longtime contributor to and supporter of community radio.
Next up on The Old Mole, we're going to look at borders and immigration as represented in a new animated film, Coco. Joe Clement and Jan Hocken review the 2017 animated film Coco, which blends an age-old story of a child's torn affection for family and the wider world with a trauma narrative about a family wound. They consider the deep emotional resonance as themes of borders, family separation, the toxicity of worldly wealth, and integrating alienated aspects of ourselves. Here's Jan.
Pixar's newest animated film, Coco, released in 2017, was meant to be a love letter to Mexico. The story follows 12-year-old Miguel Rivera, who yearns to be a great musician, but he has to hide his ambition and his guitar from his family of shoemakers who don't approve. No music, he's continually reminded by relatives who believe music cursed the family. And the film unfolds as Miguel attempts to escape this curse and the binding ties of family. So, Joe, what do you make of this central theme? Because, of course, the story of a child, typically a boy, who attempts to emancipate himself from binding kinship ties, pursuing possibilities on the horizon beyond the kinship fold, is a very old one, and often there are particular Western modern versions of this story. But let's start with the story we see in this film, Coco.
So this is, in a lot of ways, a trauma story. It is a story about going beyond the family's boundaries, but there in this story is a trauma which helps to, I think, kind of literalize the feeling of just total abandonment and upset that separation entails, both for the person going away and the people that they're going away from. And in trying to search out his roots in his quest to become a musician, Miguel is kind of going into his family's history for his family's sake. He doesn't change anything except what was understood about the past. And there is this very kind of beautiful resolution in the end where Miguel's pursuit of music and his family member who was a musician become reintegrated into the family, into its own story and living conception of itself, so that they can have both the outward-seeking individual respecting part of their family and then the tradition and their memory of that.
And some anthropologists would say that a difference between the pre-capitalist traditional story where the child explores a world beyond the kinship system and has some tests of various kind, often this is a male story of a quest to test yourself beyond the world of familial obligation. And then the denouement is that you return to the family, you return to the fold. In the Western canon, often the boy leaves and does not return. So you have here this, spoiler alert, the boy does return at the end to the familial fold. And so it carries a lot of that, the pre-capitalist commitments to familial ties that we see in immigrants also who are in this film. There's a lot of border crossing of the on the Day of the Dead that evokes our knowledge today of how difficult the border and the passport control is for people who are stopped at the borders, poor people from the South. And so the film works with border agents in a playful, animated way, but it of course is read through the present where there is painful trauma happening for families separated at the border. And so the film, it has a kind of eerie timeliness in that way. And I think the way in which the boy's quest and those who've departed still have obligations to the living, and the living have obligations to those who've gone before, is something you see in immigrant communities here, how many people, immigrant communities, send much of what they make back home across the border, how many immigrant communities around the world are supported by immigrants here. And that's not the capitalist ideal of the family, you know, where the children are much more expected to move on in the world and not return. So yet the film, I think, does carry and endorse, in a way, the right of children to follow their dreams, to leave. But it's a very ambivalent film in that way, and I think expresses a lot of the ambivalence that many people feel about the right to pursue your dream and to leave people behind, and the trauma, particularly of men who abandon their families, which was the central, as you said, the trauma of, that the film starts with.
And that's what's so interesting about the film. Another spoiler alert. Miguel decides that this famous musician, Ernesto de la Cruz, who's from his hometown, which is named after the patron saint of musicians, is his great-great-grandfather, and that explains what happened in his family. There's this guitar that matches a photo that he has off the Ofrenda, the headless photo, and he, once he gets stuck in the land of the dead, he thinks that, oh, my family here is still not going to accept me as a musician and give me their blessing so I can return to the land of the living. I will go to my family member who is a musician. And what he ends up discovering about Ernesto de la Cruz is that he stole his great-great-grandfather's songs and murdered him. And he does this by way of meeting his great-great-grandfather unwittingly. What he comes to realize about Ernesto de la Cruz is that this is this vanity, this very vain man who will kill him, this is what his family feared he'd become. It's what he ended up valorizing for so long. And then he comes to realize that, no, there is a certain kind of detached from others, a very individualistic notion of this worldliness.
It's a he has to de-idealize the object of his search, and that there was something true in the admonitions of the mother and the grandmothers, that there was something. It wasn't only a prohibition based on their neurotic overreaction, but that there was something destructive about the lure of fame.
Yeah, and Ernesto de la Cruz kills Miguel's great-great-grandfather, Hector, and so there was no possibility of reconciling, of forgiving for the initial time that he leaves. Ultimately, the film gets back to that place, but it's after he's died. But then it manifests in the family with the reintegration of just allowing music around, and it's not just Miguel. There's other people in the family who play music. It's a way of resolving that tension that doesn't go either or. It's how do we make space for change and for newness.
Yeah, and it ends with forgiving but not forgetting, you know, playing or exploring some of the conflict about people you love who let you down. This is Jan Hawken and Joe Clement talking this morning about the animated film Coco, and I would like to talk about the title of the film, which is about the grandmother who is in a state of dementia, kind of absent. It's not clear whether initially she's depressed or suffering dementia. And the film is named after her. And then at the end, she speaks. And I think in the reviews, focusing so much on Miguel the boy, who's very enchanting in this film, the matrilineal aspect of the film as it's represented can get kind of lost, particularly as you see this, the very harsh grandmother, you know, disciplining the boy, but also hugging him and holding him tight, and how that practice of holding your children tight but also disciplining them comes out of a maternal authority grounded in the material conditions of life. Throughout much of human history until the rise of industrial capitalism, households were economic units of production, and the authority of mothers was grounded in the survival of kinship systems in their communities that were productive units, as well as places where children were raised. And with the rise of capitalism, the authority of women within the household was greatly devalued because production no longer was so grounded in the family. And so you see here a version of authority passed from mother down it's still a patriarchal, larger society, but matrilineal in the sense of women carry authority passed on through their skills in as producers. But I think part of the resonance of the film was the way in which many households around the world still do have considerable female authority located within that family because women are producers. But that also, and the disciplinary aspect of that maternal authority is strengthened by the threat of all of the call of capitalism, you know, the lure of wealth and fame beyond the community. And it's very much a cautionary tale on that level that still, I think, resonates with people.
I want to respond to what you said about Coco and just notice also how she is one of the only two people in this story who actually knew Hector. And in a certain way, Imelda and the memory that Imelda, as the mother in that situation, passed down ends up being the one with all the pain of hate, of and that hate being the fuel of the prohibition, while Coco remembers her father as a child can only remember their father, and she probably maybe heard things from her mother, but...
And she received something from him.
She did. The song and you know, Hector, the in version of the Land of the Dead, if someone in the living forgets you and there's no one else to carry on your stories, then you disappear, the final death, they put it. And this is going to happen to Hector because his picture has been taken off of the family ofrenda for so long. And so getting back for Miguel is also about getting this picture back onto the ofrenda, about letting Mama Coco know that her father loved her. And the way that she kind of comes to in the end is, for me, very much a matter of finally coming to terms with, like, what happened with her papa, and really getting a message from her papa. And that's what Miguel says, you know, your father wanted you to have this. And like Miguel earlier in the film, who was admonished by his grandmother for having a secret he kept from the family, Mama Coco has her own secret, which is kind of the complement to this secret that is coming out about the family and about Miguel.
I think one reading could be that the younger grandmother is more frightened of the world and holding things together than an earlier generation who still receives something. In her case, the father who was still together enough to give to his daughter, and that had a kind of psychological validity to it, that people who live under conditions where maybe parents leave or suffer in various ways, but they have something to give their children that they can hold tight in the world, versus children who come into adulthood under conditions where life is much harder. And of course, we're seeing those differences played out all the time in the world. Children suffering more trauma than they can bear, and parents not being able to give as much to their children as the children need to hold on. And our government now is very much producing trauma for people.
Yeah, I mean, this film is all about generational trauma and how it reproduces itself.
Yeah,
not necessarily with a sociological perspective, but just how it can travel through generations and it have this kind of practical concrete. We see what's happening and how it keeps reproducing itself, but nonetheless kind of elusive and intangible.
And I also think it's very difficult to talk with children about death, and a lot of religions perpetuate forms of terrorism about hell. You're burned in hell if you don't abide by the faith, which I consider a form of psychological terrorism, to tell children that, that there's a being is going to torture you forever if you don't obey. There's none of that in this film. It really is a kind of secular film in a way. It's about how the people who die or held live only as long as the memories of people who hold them in mind, and that we have an obligation not only to remember the dead in some sentimental way, but to remember what they've taught us. And this is about what do we have to know about the kind of the warning signs in the world and the cautionary tales of people who've gone before. So it's a debt to them. And yet the old aren't over romanticized either in this film, because they also were fools in many cases. So there's an incredible variety of people in the Land of the Dead. And it's a quite remarkable film for coming out of a profit-driven industry like Pixar, owned by Disney. But I think perhaps is a response to the country getting browner.
And whatever its limits, we think that you should go see this film. But try to see it for free. You can get it through the Multnomah County Library. This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken talking about Coco.
Recuérdame. Hoy me tengo que ir, mi amor. Recuérdame. No llores, por favor. Te llevo en mi corazón y cerca me tendrás. A solas yo te cantaré, soñando en regresar. Recuérdame.
That was a clip from the lullaby Recuérdame, or Remember Me, which a father lovingly sings to his young daughter in the film Coco. To close our show today, we turn to one of the most undemocratic features of our not-very-democratic system, the U.S. Senate. Tom Becker, our well-read Red, shares an article by David Perlman and Ashley Jordan, published online June 8 in Counterpunch. If you want to know just how undemocratic the Senate is, keep listening.
Is the most undemocratic governing institution in the increasingly undemocratic U.S. system of governance. Widely populated states, such as the notoriously right-wing state of Idaho, have equal representation and power as the most populous states, such as California or New York. I am, of course, speaking of the United States Senate. It should be defanged like the British House of Lords. A growing number have an even more radical solution. Get rid of it. Who of us can look at the Senate as it functions today and not see the wisdom in this? Today I am reading an article entitled, Why We Should Abolish the Senate by David Perlman and Ashley Jordan. The article begins, While mainstream media focuses on issues related to bipartisanship in the United States Senate and on issues of Senate procedures such as the decisions to use or allow use of the filibuster or supermajority requirements for bill passage or bill consideration, they ignore a more fundamental issue, the deliberate choice to have both a Senate and a House of Representatives, rather than a single, more democratically elected body of representatives. Federalist Papers 62, generally thought to have been written by James Madison, argued for the need for a Senate in addition to a House of Representatives to prevent Congress from yielding to the impulse of sudden and violent passions and to be seduced by factious leaders into temperate and pernicious resolutions. The Senate was specifically designed to wield more power than its House counterpart and to prevent, or at a minimum to deter, an excess of democracy. That is, it was and is feared, might result if decisions such as legislation, appointments of judges, were made solely by a more democratically elected and more representative body. Consequently, the Founding Fathers specifically gave senators longer terms, 6 years, than representatives in the House, 2 years. The Senate was also assigned a singular range of key responsibilities, such as declaring war and approving judges and cabinet members, whereas the House has no such powers. Senators were initially chosen by the state legislatures, and only in 1913 was the Constitution changed, Amendment 17, to allow for direct election of senators. The Senate, by virtue of systematizing equal representation for states, still systematizes a non-equitable system of representation with respect to individuals. The number of senators is fixed at 2 per state, rather than proportionally reflecting the population size within a state. Further, under current systems of election campaign financing, candidates running for the Senate need substantially more money to run a campaign than candidates for the House, inevitably biasing the composition of the Senate toward those are backed by those with greater economic resources. Consequently, the Senate has consisted overwhelmingly of rich white men and has functioned potently to, among other things, support chattel slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and the weakening of unions and organizing efforts. The notion that the Constitution gave the United States the most perfect form of government, comprised of 3 branches and 2 houses of Congress, is often promulgated and pervasive in the U.S. educational system, in the mainstream media, and a range of elite-supported amplifying institutions. As just one recent example, in an opinion essay in the New York Times on June 3, 2021, by Ira Shapiro, a former Senate staffer to the late Senator Robert Byrd, critiques the stunt filibuster while at the same time assuming as a given that the United States urgently needs a functioning Senate, which operates, in the words of former Vice President Walter Mondale, as the nation's mediator. This type of framing of the Senate's punitive singular importance and critical role in the functioning of American democracy and its claimed role as the greatest deliberative body perpetuates the myth that the United States government cannot operate without the Senate. In fact, Mondale's quote cited in Mr. Shapiro's piece softens the role of the Senate, and so the use of the word mediator in the context of the Senate's role intentionally obscures the elitist, racist, and sexist historical and current impact inherent in the Senate's existence. Criticisms of multiple Senate procedures, such as the filibuster system, in which a single senator can block the passage of a bill supported by more than 50 senators, are entirely justified. Efforts to change these are valuable as intermediate steps and as ways to highlight the procedures used by systems of government and the strictures of government, even those delineated in the Constitution, are actually a social choice. Yet these criticisms, if taken as ends in themselves, tacitly accept the notion that having a Senate is a given, as they at once critique and reinforce the supposed critical preference of the Senate in American democracy. Yet the Constitution can, and indeed has been, changed. As noted, the process for electing senators has been changed. Some of the changes to the Constitution which have been implemented are those that have most directly contributed to sometimes small movements toward greater democracy, abolishing formal chattel slavery and allowing but not ensuring the enfranchisement of women, of Black Americans, and of those 18 years old, among others. It is therefore long past the time to recognize that continuing to have a United States Senate is a choice, and that the decision and choice to continue a form of government which denies power to and dilutes the power of its most representative branch, the House, enables a system in which national representation in Congress is not proportional to the population, in which a small minority of usually wealthy white male individuals, funded by even wealthier white males, can have and continues to ensure the preservation of white and economically elite privilege is open to discussion, to struggle, and to potentially change, albeit admittedly not easily. It is time to recognize that an important progressive goal should be not just to change Senate members or Senate procedures, or even to add states to the Union to change the balance of probable or actual members of Republicans and Democratic senators in Congress, all things that are appropriate intermediate steps, but to recognize that having the Senate was a choice made to deter progressive change and to maintain elite privilege, and that continuing to have a Senate at all is a choice, and one that continues to enable the racist, sexist, and elitist structure of the United States. For over two centuries, the system of having two houses of Congress with a more powerful and less democratic and less representative Senate has very effectively helped reinforce structural racism and class-based elitism. It is time to speak of and move towards abolishing the Senate as a branch of government. That was an article entitled Why We Should Abolish the Senate by David Perlman and Ashley Jordan. David Perlman is a physician and researcher, and Ashley Jordan is a research epidemiologist. Both have been involved in efforts to bring health care and prevention to oppressed communities. The article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage.
That wraps it up for our show today. Thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Larry Bolden, Jan Hocken, Joe Clement, and Tom Becker for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Richard A. Smith. As always, we are grateful to the hardworking staff at KBOO who do the work of keeping our community radio station on the air. Portland is blessed to still have a community radio station after many similar listener-supported stations shut down during the pandemic. With your support, we can keep it coming. If you can, please consider making a contribution today. You can go to kboo.fm and simply click on the donate button, or you can send a check to 20 Southeast 8, Portland, 97214. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Tune in next Monday at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective.